shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Shooting from the Lip with me, John Gaunt. Well, there's two stories in town, isn't there? There's the election, obviously, and of course, there's the Prince Andrew story. Well, who better to discuss this than the media consultant and former tabloid editor, Mr. Neil Wallace, who joins us now.
Shooting from the Lip.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon, John.
Have you ever known a story like this Prince Andrew one? It's completely off the scale, isn't it?
You know what? I really don't think I have, because of the twists and turns of it. You immediately go back to remembering the Princess Diana and the Prince Charles interviews, which were massive, massive events. But this is somehow different. This is tawdry. This is international. This is has been so long in the making, and it's fascinating, by the way, the royals have finally, I'm talking about the Queen and Prince Charles here, have thrown Prince Andrew under the bus.
OK, let's talk about the actual interview by Emily Maitlis. Do you think she did it well?
For me, I'm an old tabloid hack, and I find the subservience with which TV people tend to talk to the royals sort of irritating. Your Royal Highness, thank you for talking to me. Why not just say, you know, Prince Andrew, thank you for talking to me. I just detest that. I mean, I watch Newsnight regularly, and she is as tough as old boots, but there was a subservience with this that I didn't particularly enjoy. Having said that, she nailed him to the floor, didn't she?
She certainly did. Why did he do it, Neil? You'd done PR. Would you have advised him to do it?
Absolutely not. And the professional PR that he had resigned rather than be seen to be connected with it. What you have here actually is a thing that when you're in, it's now called reputation management, incidentally, or crisis management. What you have here is the classic example of a client who is completely self-obsessed, who is completely feeling sorry for themselves. And part of the job of crisis management is to say, look, all that is irrelevant. The only thing that matters is what is the right thing to do, as in the right way to present your case. Now, in this case, there wasn't a right way. He's bang to rights, other than saying, yes, I was wrong, and admissions that I'm sure he doesn't want to make, because I'm afraid the balance of opinion is very much against him.
OK, let me just clarify that. When you say he's bang to rights, you mean bang to rights that he went to see Epstein. You're not in any way suggesting he's a paedophile himself, because we don't know that, do we?
I'm not suggesting that, John. What I am suggesting, though, is that since that interview, there was before, but since that interview in particular with his appalling choice of words, I think that there is an increased there's no smoke without fire fear, completely based on nothing other than his behaviour. And that's the real danger that was going to do to himself. And that's what he did. He increased suspicion rather than allayed it. And that's just about as bad as it can get. I mean, what astonishes you, I predict here and now that his private secretary, I think she's called Amanda Thirsk, will not be in post in the next 6 months. She will have to carry the can in this because she encouraged him to do it. And when you're in crisis management, the first thing you have to do is to protect your client from themselves. They get hot under the collar. They get obsessed with telling what they see is the story that they want portraying, and you have to stop them. And you have to say, no, I'm sorry, that's not what it's about.
Yeah, that's interesting, Neil. But of course, what we can't forget in all of this is sympathy or empathy for the victims of Epstein. And that's where he's got criticised, because he didn't say a word about that, did he, really? It was all about poor old me, poor Andrew.
But, John, that's exactly my point. The very first thing that any PR would say, if you're going to do this, you talk first and foremost about your sympathy for the victims. The only thing that matters is how they are. They are the people who anybody should care about. This is very uncomfortable for me, but it's nothing compared to those poor young women.
Okay.
And, you know, that would be the very, very first thing that anybody would say. I listened to an interview this morning in which this was touched upon with Sundeep Jamin, and it was the first thing he said. You know, it's a very basic, straightforward thing. They did not know what they were doing. It was a wonderful example of in-house arrogance.
Okay, and when you talk about arrogance, is he just an arrogant knob? I mean, have you met him in your years as a tabloid editor? I mean, have you met him face-to-face?
No, I've met a whole number of the rest of them. I never met him. But his reputation in what used to be called Fleet Street in the media is simply awful. I mean, he's always been seen as a complete, arrogant, self-opinionated, uncaring, self-absorbed creature. I talked to someone the other night, quite literally, who had to sit opposite him, a newspaper editor it was actually, national newspaper editor, who sat opposite him at an official dinner, and he never even looked at him, never spoke a single word to the man opposite him across the table over a two-hour official dinner.
Why did he think it was okay to go and see somebody as a member of the royal family when this man who he was going to stay with was already a convicted sex offender?
Well, I think there's one answer that I'm confident about. The other is a supposition, but I think is going to turn out to be a major element in all of this. The first one is just a complete otherworldliness of that's what I want to do. Who dares to contradict me? Who dares argue? Who has the right to gainsay what I want to do? I mean, don't forget, in the interview, he described Epstein's paedophilia and his activities as conduct unbecoming. Mm-hmm. He's a child sex abuser, and that's how Andrew described it. And Emily Maitlis instantly picked up on that, if you remember, and he backpedaled, but it hadn't occurred to him. And so this is just, they live in a world of sycophancy where everybody tells them, yes, whatever you want, sir, that is the way it should be. And no one says boo to a goose, and particularly to him. The other thing that comes into this, in my belief, is who pays for Andrew's lifestyle. Now, there's a suggestion that the Queen pays him about £250,000 a year. He has a tiny, a small pension in his terms from the Navy. That doesn't go anywhere near covering the lifestyle that he lives. So I'm afraid we've seen it before with the royals. They do like a billionaire.
So you think that could be the motivating factor behind his friendship with Epstein, yeah?
Yes, I do. I do. Prince Charles, for years, used to go off every summer to go sailing in the Mediterranean on a Greek billionaire John Lax's yacht. What did they have in common, other than the fact of a blinking great yacht that Charles used to like to spend a fortnight on being ferried around? Those yachts cost £250,000 a week to run. And, you know, he hasn't, he's very, very happy to allow Latsis to pay that bill, while Andrew similarly has been flown around the world, lived in luxury, because particularly American, particularly foreign billionaires like to be seen with them.
So is the Queen right now then to throw him under the bus? And do you expect him to go to America and answer these questions?
Yes, the Queen was right. And you've got to remember, it must be a very desperate situation considering this is her favourite son. So, you know, it means that they understand in the palace this is a desperately bad situation for the royal family to be seen in. Do I expect him to go? I think he chose a form of words very carefully when he said words to the effect of, if required, I will give statements to law enforcement. I don't think he'll go to America to do it. I think he's more likely to invite them to come here because he would not want to be on their turf. There's an issue, John, with diplomatic immunity here. If he is in America on official business, Prince Andrew is covered by diplomatic immunity, i.e. he can't be arrested. If he's on private business, and this surely must not count as official business, but private business, he loses diplomatic immunity. Do you think he would expose himself to that? Personally, I don't, and I think the palace would advise him against it.
How damaging to the monarchy is this?
I think that it's another annus horribilis, isn't it, for the Queen?
Yeah.
And that's tragic, you know, that she's a 90-odd-year-old lady who's done this astonishing service to her country, and it all appeared to be in line, and then suddenly you have the Harry and Meghan Markle problem, and now you have this disaster. I mean, it's a PR disaster and reflects very, very badly on the Royals. The whole atmosphere that came through in that interview. Do you remember that astonishing moment where Emily Maitlis said, well, you threw a house party, didn't you, for Ghislaine Maxwell, and she brought Epstein along? Mm. And arrogance of Andrew, he said, no, it wasn't a house party. It was a shooting party.
Yeah.
You know, in John Gauntland, do you know what the difference in those are? Because in Neil Wallace world, I'm afraid that sort of his sort of astonishment that you don't know the difference and his irritation that she got such a minor thing wrong is quite eye-opening, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Ghislaine Maxwell. Where is she and what's her role within all this, of course, because her dad was Robert Maxwell, who fell off the back of the boat. You know, what is this all about? And is, you know, why haven't they questioned her, or why haven't they arrested her, or can't they find her?
Well, I suspect it might be the latter. But in America, there's a sort of grand jury system in which they are very, very protective of their inquiries. And the FBI are very, very secretive about their inquiries. What I would say is this. Get to Ghislaine Maxwell, you get to the heart of the story. She is the story. But don't forget, she's got a lot of problems now, because she has been accused of being the procuress, the madam almost, who helped Epstein recruit and traffic these women. She is in danger of facing many, many years in jail if she gets this right. But she is the keeper of all the secrets now. She knows what Epstein and Andrew did together. She's in that picture, which incidentally I don't believe for a minute is faked. You know, the one where he has his...
Oh, he's got his arm around the girl. That's ridiculous, wasn't it, what he said there? Just tell me then, I mean, obviously Epstein used his wealth and his power to create more power. I mean, there's links with him with Alistair Campbell, links with him with Donald Trump. Do you think the story's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger?
I think it would if there was a serious link to him with Trump, say, but it would have to be along those lines of girls being trafficked. Billionaires and headline-hunting billionaires basically will go anywhere for a photo opportunity, and they will do just about anything to keep themselves amongst the great and the good, because actually that's how they work together and create and develop their fortunes. So it doesn't surprise you that a billionaire hangs out with other billionaires. I mean, Bill Gates used to hang out with Epstein. I mean, Bill Gates, you know, Saint Bill Gates, sure, man of Microsoft, who's giving away literally billions of pounds to charities. He was hanging out with the guy.
They also say Epstein went 28 times to Bill Clinton's home, you know, so his tentacles are spread everywhere. If Andrew is questioned or even maybe charged, is that the end of the monarchy?
I don't think so. I think it survived in the 30s with the abdication then. I do think that it is a serious blow. And what it will do will make Prince Charles's plan that the Queen has agreed to, which is to have almost like a Denmark-style, very small core royal family, which will be the direct heir and his direct heir. So in other words, it would be down to the Queen, Charles, Harry and William. That is the royal family. That simply is the royal family. And once Charles takes over, as you know, when he becomes king, it will be William and his children underneath him. And as it carries on, people fall away and lose their privileges and position, and it will be much, much smaller. They'll have to work for a living, for instance.
That would be very popular with the British public, I think, because, I mean, I'm a royalist. I think the Queen, as you say, has done a marvellous job, but I've wanted the royal family cut down to size for years, so I don't want to get rid of it. I think that would be a good compromise, and I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that. What do you say?
I say exactly the same, John. You've just articulated exactly what I feel about it. You know, the idea that Princess Michael of Kent can still demand and get royal outriders, police outriders, stopping the traffic to take herself and her friends to Chelsea flower show opening, I just think it's a scandal. I just think it's an utter, utter outrage. You know, some minor jumped up royal can still demand police protection. Andrew, for instance, insists on complete police protection at all times, apart from when he's behind closed doors with Jeffrey Epstein, presumably. But also, he demands police knowledge, as it were, and coverage of his daughters. He demands that they have full royal status.
It's a ludicrous situation, as you say. Neil, hold on there. That's Neil Wallace. He's a PR consultant, of course, media consultant, former editor of many tabloid newspapers with his views. We're going to move on to the election and the election TV debate in a couple of moments, just after the break. So don't dare go away. You're listening to John Gaunt, Sputnik International. This is Shooting from the Lip.
Shooting from the Lip.
We're taking no prisoners here.
Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, Shooting from the Lip.
OK, welcome back to the second part of Shooting from the Lip with my special guest today, former tabloid editor Neil Wallace. Neil, the TV debates, did they impress you much?
Did they impress me? Impress is the wrong word. I was interested. I thought Boris clearly won the first half when it was about Brexit, but I think he struggled in the second half when Corbyn came more into his own as he was able to make his woolly promises. But he was also, Corbyn was also, I thought, better on his feet, as it were. He was more nimble. I think he's a more experienced debater, where Boris actually isn't that good off the cuff, unless it's his chosen off the cuff, if you see what I mean.
They both got jeered and booed and laughed at, though. It seemed to me like it's a basically a decision, vote for the person you dislike the least. I mean, they weren't impressive, were they, either of them, really?
No, they weren't. They weren't. I don't quite agree with that. I thought Boris was passionate about let's get Brexit done and the effect he believes it will have. I thought he was passionate and believable about this is a great country. We need to give it the opportunity to be great again. I thought he believed that and it came through. I thought Corbyn came through as a bit of a whinging old man. But in the main, either of them that impressive? No, I prefer Boris to the mad Marxist, but neither of them shone.
Do you believe that Boris is delivering the Brexit that we voted for three long years ago? I mean, are you comfortable with his version of this Brexit, or is it Theresa May's deal with lipstick on? That's what a lot of people say, including Mr. Farage.
I know Nigel says that. The very fact that he withdrew 300 candidates from Tory seats shows that Nigel Farage believes that what Boris can offer is better than no Brexit. I think that's what he thinks. And I think that I pretty much feel that. Do I think? My major objection to, I want some kind of Brexit. I suffer from Brexit exhaustion. I don't believe, I'm a pragmatist first and foremost, I don't believe you're going to get the kind of no-deal Brexit that Farage would like and that the European Research Group in the Tory party would like. And so a version is better than no version.
Do you believe the Brexit party is done and dusted after this election?
Almost certainly, I think. If the Tories win, then I think that you will see them pretty much sort of wither on the vine quite quickly, because their main raison d'etre, i.e. to get Brexit in some form, will have been accomplished.
Yeah, but we have to basically work out what you mean by win. He has to win by a clear majority. If it's still only 10, he's still knackered. And this is what we're forgetting. And I think the mainstream media and the broadcasters are forgetting this all the time. He's still going to get the bloody thing through Parliament. And if we just swap the swamp dwellers for new swamp dwellers who are basically singing from the same hymn sheet, he hasn't got a hope in hell, has he?
No, absolutely not. I mean, and that's the, in a way, that's the biggest problem that Nigel Farage has got, and I think he knows it, that there are many places where Labour are clinging on to seats in the north where, frankly, the Brexit Party existence may split the vote. Now, it may be that it would have been more prudent, even if he'd done it quietly, that the Tories back off to give Brexiteers, the Brexit Party, a run at those Labour candidates, because there are areas where I think no matter what, I'm a northerner. I lived in Manchester for 13 years. I was a reporter covering the north extensively. There are places up there they'd rather hang themselves than vote Tory. The resentment against many of the things, arguably right things, that the Tory governments have done over the years is just absolutely ingrained. Could they, however, I mean, there's no question that Labour has walked away from those sort of people. The Labour Party that used to represent them does not exist in the Houses of Parliament. You know, Corbyn's Labour Party, amongst all the lobbies and the university graduates and the middle class wannabes in London and the South East, have no connection to the Labour Leave constituencies at all.
Do you think in any of those seats the Brexit Party could win in places, I don't know, Wolverhampton, Walsall, and then further north? What do you think?
I think if there weren't Tories there, I think they could win some seats. The danger is that if they did win some seats, and if they held the balance of power, would we see a sort of reverse, if you like, in Parliament of the mad situation we've had in the last 18 months, where they were holding the government to ransom, where they were saying, we want a more extreme version of or a more purist version of Brexit. We want basically a no deal. We want out that way. And you end up with the same sort of paralysis that you've had with all the Remainers blocking everything over the last 18 months.
So what's your prediction then for this general election, or is it too early to call?
I think it's too early to call. I think this week is really, really vital. How the Labour manifesto goes down, how the Tory manifesto goes down, and I think this weekend will be absolutely fascinating. The opinion polls this weekend will be very, very revealing.
But they're all promising to give away. It's like Viv Nicholson on speed. It's spend, spend, spend. We haven't got the money, Neil, for either of their plannings, of their spending plans, have we?
Well, we certainly haven't got the money for mass nationalisation that the Labour Party are talking about, which are just utter, utter madness. However, I do think it is probably time we've got to be realistic about what the NHS needs. I think it's realistic about the police. I think all of those things are a sensible realisation. I thought that the idea of a sort of all-party commission after the election, if the Tories win, on social care, for instance, is so long overdue. I think there ought to be a Royal Commission on the NHS for that.
Well,
matter.
That's interesting you say that, because Lord Patel, he did a report, he's a crossbench lord, he did a report ages ago and said, look, the NHS should be taken out of party politics and we need a 10 or 15 year plan. It's the fact that it's every 4 or 5 years it's used as a football is the reason why the NHS is not progressing. I thought that was very interesting.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree. It is, look, I'll tell you, John, yesterday I spent a morning in a hospital here in London. I had to go in for some checkups. It was superb. I am sick to death of people constantly running down the NHS. But I'm aware that I do live in London, and that's where some of the great hospitals of the country obviously are. This is still a great system. The way it is used as a political football, the cynicism with which Labour say, oh, it's going to get sold off to the Americans. It's not going to get sold off to the Americans. You know, if somebody sold it off to the Americans, that party would never get elected again. And they're not, you might not like the Tories, but they're not stupid.
OK, talking of stupid, what do you make of Corbyn and what's going to be in his manifesto? Is there any chance that he could get the keys to number 10?
One of the problems we've got, John, is I'm older than you, but we remember the madness of Labour governments in the 60s and the awfulness of nationalisation. I used to have to travel up from Manchester to London, travel down from Manchester to London on the old British Rail. It took forever. It was disgusting. It was appalling and slow, etc. I remember trying to get a telephone right? And it would take, you'd literally have to book it for months ahead. And you had a choice of either a sort of cream telephone or a black telephone. And that's your choice. And you had to wait for them to decide when they could be bothered to come round. And there are myriad examples of things like that. The horrors of nationalisation. The problem is that most people, many, I've got a 35-year-old daughter. She hasn't a clue what I'm talking about. And then many of the voters are in that same position.
Yeah. What he offers is attractive, isn't it? Like his offer on the internet, free internet. It sounds fantastic. And I actually think we need broadband all over the country, no matter where you live. But I can't see how it can be free, because nothing's free. It means more tax, doesn't it?
Of course it does. It has to be paid for. But here's another interesting question then, John. Let me put this to you. You are running British Broadband. You are the guy who's providing Wi-Fi everywhere. I'd like you to block all videos that could encourage self-harm, please. You going to do that? Because if you take it further along then, I'd like you to block all soft porn. Are you entitled to do that? Should you be able to do that? I'd like you to block car ads. I want you to block car ads because they encourage climate change. I mean, should the state be deciding these things? Should the state be running these things? And the answer is, look at China. Because you know what happens in China? If something's going on they don't like, they turn it off. In India, when the Indian government took over Kashmir recently, when they sort of ended the sort of semi-independence of Kashmir, first thing they did, they turned off the internet.
OK, got to finish now, Neil. Just then, in a word or two, is Boris going to be the Prime Minister at the end of this?
Yes.
That was a word. Thank you very much indeed. That was Neil Wallis, the media consultant and former editor of tabloid newspapers, with his views. I'll be back next week with another guest who'll be just as forthright here on Shooting from the Lip on Sputnik International. Until then, thanks for listening.
Shooting from the Lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting from the Lip.